NHPR.net. It's 9:07, and this is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this year, more than 100 Granite State doctors and medical personnel learned they may have been victims of identity theft when their personal information was obtained during the process of filing their taxes. But as alarming as this was for those individuals, their story is just a drop in the identity theft bucket, with more than 16 million Americans experiencing this problem in 2012 at a cost of nearly $25 billion. And it turns out the United States is especially vulnerable for several reasons. An IRS that lacks the nimbleness to detect fraud before the agency sends out tax returns, and an outmoded credit card system whose vulnerability was exposed, once again, in a massive data breach at Target late last year. Now there are calls for national policies aimed at these problems, and consumers, too, are being told to pay much closer attention to their financial activities to help spot trouble early. Today in The Exchange, identifying the causes of identity theft. Let's hear from you. Have you had your personal information stolen? What do you think the solution is? Is it a matter of technology, regulations, or a private sector issue? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests joining us from New York City is Anna Marie Andriotis. She's a reporter who covers consumer credit for The Wall Street Journal. Anna Maria, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
It's great to be here with you.
Also with us in studio, Doug Shadell, Senior State Director of AARP Washington, based in Seattle. He's written several books, including Outsmarting the Scam Artists. He'll be the keynote speaker tomorrow in New Hampshire at the AARP New Hampshire's Scam Jam on June 24th. And Doug Shadell, welcome to New Hampshire, and thanks for being here.
My pleasure to be here, Laura.
Well, Doug, what is identity theft? Give us a sense of the range of experiences that people have.
Well, I think the simplest definition is when someone takes over your personal credit profile and tries to become you in order to use your credit for their own personal use. That's not a legal definition, but that's essentially what happens. And there are really two different ways to do this. There's sort of the low-tech way and the high-tech way. We've read about, as you mentioned in your open, the high-tech breaches that are occurring at Target and eBay. This is where who knows who is somewhere in the world breaking in, hacking into these databases and accessing your personal information. It's hard to know how to prevent that. All you really can do is monitor your credit, and we'll talk more about that,
I hope,
later.
Or pay cash.
Yeah, I guess so, right. The low-tech way is, I think, something you can prevent, and we've spent a lot of time coaching people on how to do that. The low-tech way is stealing people's mail out of their mailboxes, breaking into cars and getting, breaking into cars and getting your laptop or personal information, going and dumpster diving. Those are the sort of old school ways, but believe it or not, they're still being done today to steal your identity.
Well, I was wondering about that because I remember 5 or 10 years ago, there was a lot of attention on, shred your data and,
right,
don't put stuff in the trash until it's all ripped up or burn it in your fireplace or whatever. Now it seems like most of the attention is on the credit cards, the online stuff, but you're saying both is still happening.
Both. And when you get, I recently interviewed a person who pled guilty to this crime in Seattle, and she was both. She had a network of people, this is really closely tied to methamphetamine, the low-tech version. Drug addiction is what drives a lot of this. So they're breaking into cars and stealing mail and jumping into garbage. But then this particular person was also a computer expert. And so she would take this information and start hacking into your personal files with it.
Yeah. Anna Maria, how about you? What are you seeing? What are you reporting on?
So for sure, the types of identity theft that seem to have the biggest impact on consumers are these large data breaches. Like you mentioned, the Target example late last year, I mean, this was so widespread. There was card information of up to, initially they said it was card information of up to 40 million people that was stolen. And then we also found out that additional information like names and mailing addresses and other contact information of another 70 million people was stolen. We also saw Neiman Marcus, a data breach there. So it's increasingly, from for many consumers becoming the case that, you know, you sort of go about your everyday business. You go shopping, you take out a debit card or a credit card, and little do you know, but that information of yours is being stolen as you are swiping it through the technology there at the register. So the biggest problem from what we've seen here is that you're sort of doing things as you're supposed to be doing them, you know, sort of going about your everyday business, and little do you know, but your information is being stolen. Oftentimes, as in the Target example, you don't really find out right away. Several weeks, if not more, will pass before you have any idea that something like this has happened.
You know, it's interesting. I sort of said offhandedly you could pay cash, Anna Maria, but and in some instances you can. If you want to buy groceries, you can certainly pay cash. But there's a lot of stuff, Anna Maria, that you can't do today with cash. Buying an airline ticket, you know, renting a car, signing up for a local 5K. I mean, it's all done online. It's all done by credit card. So in some sense, you can't really escape this.
That is correct. You know, a lot of what we do obviously occurs online with the items that we purchase, so can't really do much there in terms of paying with cash. But there's also the other side to this, which is that, you know, for a while, for many years, people have been hearing that, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't be paying with cash because cash, if you lose it, let's say if it happens to fall out of your pocket or you misplace it, that's it. It's gone. Whereas there's more protections, assuming that you're in control of all of your information. There are more consumer protections if you're using your credit card and you see a charge on there that isn't yours, or you're trying to remove a charge, maybe if you're trying to return something. Similarly, with a debit card, while the protections are fewer than they are with credit cards, they still happen to be more than with cash. The problem with cash is that if you lose it, it's basically gone. And so that's why we've seen these data breaches really become such an issue for people, because consumers really have been conditioned over many years to sort of make the transition from cash to plastic. And now we're seeing the repercussions of that move, one of them being identity theft and data breaches.
Yeah, let me invite our listeners to join us, and then a bunch more questions for both of you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Join us with your questions, comments, personal experiences with this issue we're talking about, identity theft, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment there if you like. Or again, give us a call at 1-800-892-NHPR. So since we're talking about the credit card problem, Doug, let's go there. How big a component is credit card identity theft of this overall problem of ID theft? You know, is it a third of the problem, half the problem?
I'm not sure that I'm the one who can give you all of the detail. Well, actually, yes, I can. I happen to the Federal Trade Commission does a lot of work in this domain, and they've promulgated rules and principles to address this problem. But they also have they take complaints on identity theft. And in 2012, 46% of the complaints that they received had to do with government documents, maybe the IRS scam, Social Security and Medicare cards, and we can talk about that. 13% of them were related to credit cards, 10% over the phone, 6%. So these numbers, the caveat to these numbers is, as you mentioned in your opening, there was a study that showed that somewhere between 12 and 16 million people a year fall prey to this. It's not clear what that number is. But the Federal Trade Commission, just by comparison, in 2012, received about 400,000 complaints. So these numbers do not reflect what's actually going on out there. It's grossly underreported.
Yeah. Do people really know what's gone on?
But, you know, the reality is that credit cards are vulnerable. But as your other guest said, I really believe that the safest way still to buy things is with your credit card, because you have this federal protection that if fraud occurs on a credit card, all but $50 must be removed by the bank. The financial institutions are really the ones who are paying the bill for identity theft. The consumer, however, is the one who pays the sort of emotional anxiety bill for worrying about, oh, what do you mean somebody has my Social Security number? Where else might they show up? And this can go on for years. So I think the bill is being paid by industry, but the emotional cost is being borne by the consumer.
Well, and speaking of industry and paying the bill, there's been a lot of talk, Doug, about, you know, industry could protect itself better if it would put better chips in our credit cards like they have in Europe. Why don't we have those more secure credit cards? I think I heard somebody compare ours to, you know, cassette tapes and Europe's to, you know, modern DVDs. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think when the bill gets high enough, those innovations will occur. It's really, I mean, the tension here is between security and convenience, really.
And cost.
And cost, exactly. And those three forces are butting up against each other all the time. When we go into a room and try and tell our members how to avoid identity theft, there's a lot of things you can do, but they're not particularly convenient. people want to do things faster and faster and spend money faster and faster and so forth. And there's got to be some recognition that convenience comes at a cost.
Well, and Anna Maria, definitely want to get you in on the credit card situation, why ours aren't as secure as Europe. But just you piqued my interest, Doug. So things you can do to protect yourself from identity theft that maybe aren't convenient, but go ahead.
Well, one of the simplest things, and we got this from, again, interviewing several identity thieves who say, you know, we steal laptops and we steal smartphones. If you don't have a password code on your smartphone, so before you can use your phone, you have to enter a 4-digit code, and then that phone gets lost, and it's synced up to all of your personal accounts, and you've auto-loaded all the passwords into all of your websites, that person becomes you without having to do anything. Okay? It's inconvenient to have to enter that 4-digit code, but it protects you in case you lose it from someone who's going to just take over all of your accounts potentially.
Okay, so that's a quick and easy. Give me one more, Doug, and then we'll take a quick break.
One more way to protect yourself. Well, this goes back years, but locking your mailbox.
Really?
Yes, locking your mailbox. We just drove around with an identity theft thief in Seattle, and she was pointing out how many – nobody had a locking mailbox. You know, there's like – I thought this was in the news, you know, but on my street, nobody locks their mailbox, or very few do, and they still go around. And when you put that red flag up, that's called flagging. The thief will stop and go, flag.
Mail's there.
Steal the mail.
Let's get it.
Yep.
All right. More after a short break. And Anna Maria, I want to hear from you, too. We'll take your calls as well at 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR's fiscal year comes to a close this Sunday, and thanks to all of our members who have shown their support with a gift. While we continue to plan for the news we know is coming and prepare for the breaking news we can't predict, we need your help to meet our year-end goals. Please make your donation at nhpr.org, and thank you. Partly to mostly sunny day across New Hampshire. Highs today, mid-70s to lower 80s. Then partly cloudy tonight. Overnight low temperatures in the 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Clark's Trading Post in Lincoln, a family theme park for over 80 years featuring trained bears, acrobatic circus, steam train rides, Segway Park, and museums, whitemountainsattractions.com. And the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, everything made from organic and sustainable materials, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're identifying the causes of identity theft and why this is such a rising problem in America. Let's hear from you. Have you had your personal information stolen? Have you been a victim of identity theft? What do you think the solution is? Is it better technology, tougher regulations, better monitoring by consumers themselves, or does the private sector need to get its act together on this? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can post a comment there or just give us a call, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests are Doug Shadell, Senior State Director of AARP Washington. He's based in Seattle. He's in New Hampshire this week to deliver a keynote address called Outsmarting the Scam Artists at AARP New Hampshire's Scam Jam tomorrow. Also joining us from New York City, Anna Maria Andriotta. She's a reporter who covers consumer credit for The Wall Street Journal. And Anna Maria, to you too, this big debate, especially after the Target breach late last year, about why American credit cards aren't as secure as European credit cards.
It basically comes down to the fact that retailers need to get on board, as do the credit card issuers, in terms of adopting the technology that's needed. So you basically need two things in order to really increase the level of security surrounding credit cards. These chip-enabled credit cards, which are widely used in Europe, are a whole lot more secure than what we have here, which is just basically this credit card with a magnetic strip. So basically, what needs to occur is that the credit card issuers need to start offering more of these credit cards. Some already do, though they're not widely used. But the problem is that even those companies that do offer these credit cards, there are very few stores that you can go to in the U.S. where they have the technology to actually accept those cards. Now, the reason why these cards are so much more secure is essentially they're embedded with this microchip. This is the chip that sort of transmits your data. Oftentimes what happens is the information in this chip is encoded in a way that each time you use it, it changes. So let's say you swipe your card at a store and that machine is tampered with, and there's a thief somewhere who is collecting the data from your credit card. The information that they got from your chip, this number, is a number that will be different next time you go shopping. In addition, these cards typically require that you also put in a PIN number like you would with a debit card, right? So we kind of have the best of both worlds here. This chip that's sort of this really high tech piece of equipment here that is very difficult to breach, and also the fact that you will be required to put in your actual PIN number at the point of sale. So we've seen some companies come out with these cards, and some retailers begin accepting these cards. So Walmart and its subsidiary Sam's Club are two big examples here where they are beginning to accept these cards. Also, Target, no coincidence following its breach, announced in April that it was going to be switching to this model and hopes to do so in all its stores by early next year. So we are seeing a transition happening, but it appears to be happening at a very slow pace.
Interesting. So the scenario then right now seems like, Anna Maria, is, some consumers might actually have two different credit cards, and this is the one I use to shop at Walmart and Target, and it's more secure, and I'm feeling good about that, and this is the one I use everywhere else.
So it's still early on to know exactly how this will work, but it seems like you might even be able to use these credit cards at a sort of a regular register like you would right now, but the safety aspect of these cards wouldn't really come into play.
I see. Wouldn't
kick in.
In
order for them to really sort of work to their fullest extent, you'd not only need to have the credit card with this chip technology, but you'd also need to be at a store where the register is equipped with the payment technology to accept this card. The other problem that we've already seen with these types of credit cards is that some major credit card issuers have already rolled out these credit cards with these chips, and you can call them up and ask them for it, and they'll send it to you, but they don't require you to put in a PIN at the register, like a PIN number. Instead, it's like a signature, like it is with a regular card. So there are already some critics coming out saying that they're not really developing these credit cards to the fullest extent in terms of implementing all the security measures
Wow.
that are available in Europe. So there's already this sort of debate raging about, the sort of safety and soundness of these new cards.
Yeah, and sometimes smaller retailers, I have seen in my own experience, won't accept them. I won't go into long, boring details, but I've seen friends and relatives from Europe try and use these. They can't, or the retailer doesn't have the little pad code for him to put in the PIN. I mean, it gets kind of messy. Doug, real quick to you, and then we'll go to our callers.
Yeah, I just think this is another example of, from the perspective of the merchant, the percentage of transactions that really involve identity fraud is still relatively low. And so the argument is, do we need to change our entire infrastructure just for these things? And that is a legitimate beef. And I think as we think about the principles of how to prevent this, it always has to be gauged against, the businesses who have to make a living in their cost structure. So.
Sure. But 70 million people at Target, that's a lot of folks.
Yes,
yeah.
That is.
All right. Let's go to our listeners. Again, the number in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan's been waiting in Great Haverhill Lake. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Dan.
I use my credit card for everything, to pay my utility bills, Comcast, whatever. And over the last couple of years, I've gotten notices from my bank that someone has been using my credit card in, like, a Walmart in North Carolina, and I've had to change my credit card a couple times. I wonder how that happens and why. And what can I do to make that stop?
Yeah, it's a pain in the neck, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is.
Dan,
I mean, that's a lot of things.
Yeah, I've changed my card several times in the last couple of years for similar concerns. Doug, to you first, please.
Well, one thing that I was going to mention in the domain of prevention and also this whole monitoring business. If you're not monitoring your credit card bill online, you should get an online access to your credit card immediately. Don't wait for the credit card company to contact you and say there's some problem. There are so many examples. And I used to be one of these people. I didn't trust online banking myself. It's only been a couple of years since I've done online banking. I just didn't trust them. I thought it was unsafe and I was putting myself at risk. Actually, you're putting yourself at much greater risk now because everything is online. If you don't have online access, plus the identity thief can actually, if you don't have online access or telephone access to your credit card, they can hack in. And if they have your Social Security number, create their own online access to your credit card with their own password and code, and then you can't have access to your own account. So it's really important for monitoring purposes and also to avoid these people who are trying to take over your account to get online access to all your credit accounts.
Yeah. So what do you think about our caller's story, Dan? He says, you know, somebody's been using my credit card. I've had to change it. It's a pain in the neck. Is this the future, Doug? I mean, we're just going to have to get used to changing our credit cards every, 12 months or 18 months?
I hope not. But I used to say, I've been doing fraud prevention for 30 years, and we used to say, whatever you do, when someone calls, don't give your credit card number out over the phone because you don't know who they are. And that's still true. But I actually think the safest way to purchase something, at least today, is to use your credit card. You have a federal protection against any fraud that happens, assuming that you notify the card issuer within 60 days. But that means you have to monitor that account to be able to know if there's a fraudulent charge. I still think that it's relatively safe to use credit cards.
Yeah. What do you think, Anna Maria?
I totally agree with Doug. With the options between cash, debit, and credit card, I would recommend credit card. I use my credit card pretty much for everything that I buy, and there's several reasons for that. The biggest one is what Doug mentioned, which is the fact that you will not be liable for fraudulent charges on your credit card beyond $50. And in fact, most banks will even waive that $50.
Yeah.
So in many cases, you might not even have to pay anything in terms of fraudulent charges. That is very different with debit cards. Depending on how much time passes from when you realize that there's been some type of a breach, somebody has fraudulently gotten into your account, taking your cash out, and you actually notify the bank. I mean, you are looking at a best case scenario of not being liable for anything, but at a worst case scenario of not being able to get any of the cash that was taken out of your bank account back. So credit cards are the way to go, and there are a couple ways to sort of steps to take to protect yourself when using credit cards. So one thing to consider is that if you request this, most credit card issuers will alert you by phone or if you choose another means. But they can alert you pretty much immediately by phone about charges beyond a certain dollar amount. So let's say that you know that the chances of you going out there and getting a $1,000 handbag or, something sort of really expensive that is just not, part of your lifestyle. If this is something you would not do, then one thing you could consider is you call up your credit card issuer and you say, listen, if you ever get any charges beyond $500 for an item or beyond a certain dollar amount,
sure,
I want you to give me a call and to alert me. And they do that. I've actually set that up, and I'll get a call saying, we just saw this transaction. Is this you? And the call literally comes, within about half an hour or so. So there is a little bit of lag time, but really not much. And it's a way to sort of address the problem, if there is one, before waiting for that statement to come in the mail. And as Doug mentioned, setting up your account so you can also check what's happening online is important. People who do not want to use credit cards, if you want to stick with debit cards, and there is an argument for that, right? People don't want to get themselves into credit card debt. So they'll say, no, I'm just going to stick with my debit card because I only want to spend the cash that I have. In that case, what's very important is you really need to be checking your account online on a daily basis to make sure that there aren't any transactions on there, there haven't been any withdrawals that have occurred from your account where you were not the person who actually did that.
Here's another question. After big breaches like Target and Neiman Marcus that we've talked about, Doug, there were several companies who were very happy to sell consumers ID theft protection plans for $10, $20, $30, $40 a month. Are these worth it? And why aren't the financial institutions and the retailers doing a better job in the first place so that we don't have to spend extra money?
Well, that's a really good question. There are a lot of companies marketing these ID theft prevention programs now. The way I kind of look at it, at first I was like, come on, you can do all of this yourself. What's the point?
But someone, you meaning the consumer?
Meaning the consumer. And I think some of the – and you can do a lot of it yourself. If anybody tells you, though, that they could prevent you from being an ID thief, you should run away because no one can really absolutely prevent it because of the breaches, things that are out – externalities that are out of our control. The way I liken it is, you know, there are some people who like to go out to a restaurant and eat, and it costs a little more. Someone else is preparing the food. Other people hate going out to a restaurant. They want to buy their own food and cook their own meal. You know, so if you're willing to pay for somebody else to do some of the basic monitoring, then perhaps it's worth it. I mean, I can tell you I'm never going to do that because I'm much more, I guess I cook at home more or something. that's sort of the way, the trade-off. I would be very careful about investigating the claims people make, though, before you sign up for one of these programs about what it can really do. What it can really help you, I think, the most is if you actually become a victim and then there's some services they can do to help you get out of
it. So sort of mop
up
services.
But none of them can prevent it.
Yeah. And I also wonder, you know, you start to get paranoid if you've been a victim of ID theft. How do you know which companies are, you know, legit institutions? You're giving them your data as well.
Yeah. Well, and as this case I just was describing, the identity thief I interviewed actually purchased identity theft prevention protection for the person she was victimizing.
Really?
And then
come on.
Had the report sent to a P.O. box where only she could access it so that as she was stealing the person's identity, the reports were coming to her about her own theft of the victim. So, you know, there's some things that you just can't prevent. But I think if you look at it in terms of I don't have time to do all of this stuff. I mean, I'm just somebody who wouldn't want to delegate all of that myself. But
sure.
Some people are very busy. Some of that can be done by some of this.
All right. Let's take another call. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us as we look closer at identity theft, why it continues to rise. 1-800-892-6477. Give us your stories, questions, personal experiences with this issue. 1-800-892-6477. Email again, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. And let's go next to Jamie in Nashua. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for waiting. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Good morning. I was calling because of two points. One is that I was a victim of identity theft, and it was back in 2002. So it was well before there was a mass media explosion of the problem. So it was extremely difficult back then to fight these, you know, identity theft charges. And one of the things that I have found that was not helpful, which I see now in advertising for identity theft protection services, is just looking at a credit score. My credit score never dipped. I had an excellent credit score near 800 throughout this whole process of trying to fight my identity theft. And what I should have been doing was looking at an itemized identity, an itemized credit, you know, report where it lists all of your accounts and the recent activity on it in detail, because that's where all the proof was, not in just the score.
Yeah. So how did you emerge from this, Jamie?
Yeah, it's a good question. Not easily, that's for sure.
Sure.
It was just a lot of just trying to prove that I was who I was, which was extremely difficult. The person or persons who stole my identity sold it out to somebody in Columbus, Ohio. And all of the accounts that were opened either through like local store accounts that were only in that part of the country. So those ones were a little bit easier to prove that that wasn't me. But other accounts were not. And that was really the difficult thing. I mean, it's been a while, so I don't exactly remember what I had to do. I remember having to get affidavits that I was working in Boston and I was living in, you know, in Massachusetts at the time. And it really just kind of, you know, over the top things to feel like, gee, I am who I am.
Yeah, it just kind of takes over your life, too. I mean, it's not like, you know, Jamie doesn't have anything else to do. What do you think about this story, Anna Maria? And Jamie, thanks a lot for calling.
I think she made several interesting points. The credit score point, by far, I'm in total agreement with her. Credit scores are not the way to go in terms of whether you're trying to check to find out if you've been a victim of identity theft. And credit reports, in fact, are the way to do that. Credit reports, which you can get from the three major bureaus, that's Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, will list for you all of the accounts that you have that exist in your name with regards to credits or whether it's credit cards or any types of loans that you have. And you'll see whether there are accounts there that have been opened that you never opened. You'll also see whether there are charges racked up on accounts that you didn't rack up. I also think what was really important to what she said is sort of the way that her information was sort of sold. And I think this touches on one point that is really crucial. The fact that there really is this sort of black market, a pretty large one, and that basically exists with regards to just selling people's information. You have social security numbers, credit card numbers that are being sold there, and it's very difficult for anybody to be able to sort of get things in order to sort of put an end to this once their information has been stolen. Also, not to sound too bleak, but the credit bureaus are not exactly very helpful when it comes to helping consumers to remove fraudulent accounts from their credit reports. I've heard several stories from consumers who've just been sort of fighting this battle for years.
Like our caller, Jamie.
Accounts.
Yeah. And Maria, hang on, and we're going to take a super short break. And when we come back, I want to ask both of you about another type of identity theft that's on the rise concerning taxpayers and information they give to the IRS. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the Iraq crisis and the security threat it poses to the region and the U.S. Then, a new novel by the author of The Imperfectionists, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. It'll be partly to mostly sunny across New Hampshire for today. We'll have high temperatures mid-70s to the lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. Support also comes to us from Ansel & Anderson, Trust and Estate Attorneys in Bedford, helping clients with thoughtful planning for all the transitions of your life, on the web at anslpa.com. And from LRG Healthcare, presenting an information session on Makoplasty, robotic joint replacements for hips and knees on June 24th at Lakes Region General Hospital, lrgh.org. 9:40, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the decline in bee populations and the threat to global agriculture. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're talking about identity theft. Join us now with your thoughts, questions, comments, personal experiences with this issue. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange, all one word, to continue the conversation there as well. Before we go back to our listeners, Anna Maria and Doug, I did want to ask you both about another type of identity theft that I have read is rising. And Doug, this concerns taxpayer-based ID theft. Now, what is that?
This is really, you know, right around January or February of every year, we all get very similar mail. We get our 1040s and all of our end-of-year tax information. So basically, this type of scam involves stealing your identity to file a false tax return in your name. And again, remember we talked about low-tech, high-tech ways to do this. The low-tech way to do it is in January, the mail thieves working for identity theft people go out and steal your 1040s that come in the mail. Not everybody gets them in the mail, but a lot of people still do. And then they use those to take over your identity and file a false tax return. Or in the case of myself, my wife and I actually had this happen to us in January. A hacker hacks into the Archdiocese of Seattle. The Catholic Archdiocese of Seattle had a hack. 90,000 records were exposed. Those 90,000 people were volunteers and teachers in the Diocese of Seattle. My wife volunteers at my 13-year-old daughter's Catholic school. In order to volunteer, you have to give them your social security number so they can do a criminal background check on you. How ironic is this? And they, sure enough, I called the IRS because their alert went out. I called the IRS. They said, you filed your tax return January 20th. No, I didn't. Okay, well, you've had a false tax return signed using your wife's social security number. So then you have to call the IRS. You have to file an affidavit of identity theft. You have to file a police report, and you're into it now. And the problem is that number is now out there for a long time. There are many, you know, we don't know where her social security number is going to go next. And identity thieves will tell you that these numbers can circulate and recycle for years.
See, that's creepy because it's easy to change, relatively easy to change your credit card. It's a pain in the neck, and then you have to call all those companies who have an automatic withdrawal, but you can't change your social security.
So what did I do? Right. Yeah. One of the things I did, and we haven't talked about this yet, is at the state level, you can do what's called a credit freeze. You can call actually, I guess it's not a state. State laws differ, but in Washington state, if you've been a victim of identity theft, you essentially contact the credit bureaus. And I couldn't agree more with Anna Maria that it's hard to get this stuff off your credit. And it's also hard to sort of sometimes deal with the credit bureaus. But a credit freeze essentially means that no one can use your name and your credit file to get new credit. You can continue to use your existing credit, but unless you're notified and authorize it. So I'm going to have a credit freeze on my account. With all three credit bureaus, probably forever now, just to be safe.
Because your wife's social security number is floating
out there. Yeah.
So what does this say to you about the IRS and its, lack of ability to protect people from ID theft?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think this is a big problem. And I mentioned this to a couple of the identity thieves we were interviewing for a video we're making. And, you know, because they file, everyone in the archdiocese had a phony tax return filed. Like, you know, there's this relationship between breach and what percentage of those breaches are actually converted to identity theft. And there's this company called Javelin that annually does a survey of 5,000 people. And they said that 4 years ago, 1 in 9 people whose name was breached actually became an identity thief because they survey these people and ask them, did you get a breach notification? Were you a victim? Last year, it was 1 in 3. What does that say about the bad guys? Maybe they're doing a better job of targeting. There are more of these breaches, at least this based on this one survey. It looks like there are more of these breaches that are actually being converted to identity theft. So it's really going on out there. But the identities I interviewed said, what a bunch of amateurs. You mean they just stole 90,000 social security numbers and immediately tried to convert them? And then there's a big news story about it and it's all over? That's lame. You should take those 90,000 and just over time work them so nobody ever knows, you know.
Sure, one at a time. Yeah.
I mean, this became a huge, big story in the city there, and they closed it all down, and the IRS knows all about it, and they, you know, so.
Well, there have been a lot of stories about IRS taxpayer fraud. And so what they do then, Doug, just to make sure I'm crystal clear on this, is they get your information, they file a return early with the IRS, and they say, hey, give me my $3,000 return or whatever.
Yeah.
And the IRS says, sure, Doug, here you go. And then when the real Doug goes to file his tax return, the IRS says, no, we already gave it to you.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. And part of that is the pressure, I suppose, to get tax returns out more quickly, to have them all be electronic and so forth.
Okay, let's go back to our listeners. And Josh is waiting in Plymouth. Hi, Josh. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, I work for an employment agency, and several of the people I work with fill out, you know, several applications online or paper, and they all the applications ask for Social Security, and it got me thinking, you know, why do employers need this right initially, right off the bat, before they hire you? And is there a risk in, you know, putting out your Social Security on 3 or 4 applications a day? Is that
sure? And people apply for jobs online and so forth. It's a good question, one I hadn't thought of. Doug, what do you think, Anna Maria? Do you know anything about this?
Well, part of the reason why they ask for your Social Security number is because many employers run a credit check on you before they hire you. They will use your Social Security number to get your credit reports and to, it sounds surprising to many people, but they will use credit reports as part of their decision-making process to decide whether or not to hire you. This has been something that's been pretty controversial over the past few years, especially with the last economic recession. That employers will make decisions about whether to hire people in part based on whether they've done things like filed for bankruptcies, had a foreclosure, things of that sort. In general, social Security number is needed for the employer to verify that you are who you say you are, but it's also because credit report checks are often run.
Well, and for immigration status and so forth, right, Anna Maria? I mean, you kind of do need
all
to give
that,
it to them, don't
right.
you?
Right. They need to confirm that you are who you say you are and that you are here legally and that, right, that all of that stuff checks out. And then there's also the credit report front, which is where they will look over the credit report to determine whether or not you're someone who they want to hire. Not all employers do this, but many do.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Doug, too? It does seem like more and more people are asking for your Social Security number.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you in the case of the Diocese of Seattle, now you can volunteer without giving them their Social Security number. And there is the government is getting a little smarter about this. But, you know, there's still 50 million Medicare cards that have a Social Security number on it. And we tell our members at AARP, do not carry your Medicare card around with you. Don't carry your Social Security number on you. There's no reason for it. You don't need it when you go to the doctor. The doctor already has it.
So. All right. Well, thanks for the call, Josh. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's a Facebook comment from Roger. He says, my credit card number is stolen and used for fraud so often that I now keep a list of the organizations that normally do recurring charges, including NHPR, says Roger. Thank you, Roger. Along with their phone numbers and websites to save time when I have to go through the tedious process of changing the card number in all of those places. So, Anna Maria, there's Roger doing what you guys have been talking about, which is, you know, consumers keeping an eye on it themselves. What are some of the other big fixes, though, that Anna Maria, that people are talking about? You know, we've talked about individual responsibility. We've talked about credit card companies. Who else sort of has a role in making this better?
We've talked about the major players. I mean, there's always, you know, questions about whether there will be regulation or the government stepping in to try to add some consumer protections here. We really haven't seen much movement. I mean, over the years, there's been some sort of very narrowly focused pieces of legislation that have been introduced to address some scope of, you know, pertaining to identity theft, whether it's, you know, if your data is stolen from your doctor's office or retailers, but nothing has really moved forward there. So for the time being, it really is a matter of, are the retailers willing to upgrade their technology? Are the credit card issuers willing to switch from these sort of plain vanilla credit cards that we all have to these cards that have more enhanced security? And what that means is that for the time being, this really largely does rest on the consumer to make sure that even if there is a breach, even if their identity is stolen, the steps that they can take to try to sort of limit the damage. I know we've gone over a few points, but if it's okay, I just want to quickly throw out a few other tips to consider. Now, we talked about how banks, you know, sell these credit monitoring services. And I agree with Doug. I think I'm actually a little bit more extreme in this in terms of I really don't think there's much of a reason to use these services because essentially, like Doug pointed out, you are paying for what you can essentially do yourself and what you can do yourself many times for free. Just to give you a few examples, consumers can check their credit reports from each of the three credit bureaus for free every 12 months. There's a website called annualcreditreport.com that's totally free. You don't have to pay anything to do this. You can place a, I know Doug mentioned the freeze, and if you are a victim of identity theft, you can usually place a freeze on your credit report for free. And some states, even if you're not a victim, will also do this for free. And the most that it can be, at least as far as we're aware of here, is about $10 per credit bureau. However, that is still cheaper than what you'll pay with the bank services. And one last point to consider, there are also things called fraud alerts that you can place on your credit report. You can do this with one of the credit bureaus. You don't have to go to all three of them. And you can do this for free. And what this alert will do is it will notify lenders to take extra steps to confirm that the identity of the person applying for credit in your name, that it's actually you. So believe it or not, you have to place this alert in order for lenders to sort of do that double check to confirm that you are who you say you are. But these are some steps that you can do that are either free or very sort of at a low cost, especially when compared to these bank programs. And we've seen the bank programs get in trouble recently. I mean, just in April, Bank of America reached this $770 million agreement with regulators over deceptive credit card practices that included these ID theft protection services.
Making promises that weren't necessarily kept or were
exactly
too broad.
There were questions about its marketing. There were questions about its billing practices over these identity theft protection services. Also, Chase has been ordered to pay. This was back in September of last year. Chase was ordered to pay some $309 million for a questionable credit card practices, including the ID theft protection services. This is a space that has not been regulated. The banks have come under a lot of pressure since the recession financially. Regulators have added all these laws that have reduced their revenues. However, there have been no laws added to address these identity theft protection products, which basically allows them to kind of, it's almost kind of free game. You know, they could do as they please until
it's a growth area for profit
exactly,
for them. Interesting, because people are so concerned about this. That's really interesting. And Doug, I wonder what you think. You know, we've talked a lot about individuals and what we all can do, but who else, in your opinion, needs to have more skin in the game here?
Yeah.
Or needs to step it up?
Well, I agree that this area is unregulated, and I sometimes worry that all of our knowledge about how this works and talking about it on the radio really just fuels people's interest to go right to and buy something, buy some kind of insurance out of fear. So I do worry about that. You know, the Federal Trade Commission in 2012 issued a report that was sort of trying to identify principles that industry should look for. And one of them, and we always say this, but one of them is the question of greater transparency. When you get a privacy statement, it should be easy to understand. The consumer should be able to read it. But the problem, and this sort of gets us back to the consumer, we did a survey in February of 11,000 internet users and asked them if they'd ever read those privacy statements or those terms of agreement. And 39% said they'd never read the term of agreement, and yet they clicked, "I agree with it." And 35% said, "I'd never read any of the privacy statement." So it's one thing to encourage more transparency, but if the consumer doesn't read it, you know, in my world, the con artists say victims aren't readers and readers aren't victims. You still have to do some due diligence here.
Boy, but those things are long.
And I know they
are. It's all this technical language.
It doesn't solve
the whole
thing.
You read it, but you don't really understand it.
I mean,
I'm sort of guilty as charged. You know, I just sort of click, yeah.
I know.
Because I'm busy and I need to get on to the next thing.
Yeah, it's really true. The other thing I just want to add, I agree with everything that Anna Maria said about the problems here. But getting online access to the credit bureaus, when you get that credit check, that free credit check, register yourself with the bureaus online. Because we've seen identity thieves who have taken over an identity and gone online and become the person with the credit bureau, which means then you get their credit bureau accounts, as Anna Marie was talking about. Oh, here's your entire credit history. And then they take over all of those accounts. So get online access to monitor your credit cards. Get online access with credit bureaus. I can't believe I'm saying this. I used to be the one who's afraid of all of this. But I really believe this is the way to protect
yourself.
Well,
after what happened to you and your wife, too.
And also, if you get telephone access, because they can create their own telephone access to your credit card, even if you have online. So
You know, Doug and Anna Maria, we just have about 1 minute left. And Doug, I am interested in this video that you say you're working on where you interviewed ID thieves who've been caught and prosecuted and so forth. We don't have that much time, but what's the number one thing that you've learned from these folks?
That's a good question. Well, we've interviewed a lot of cons over the years, and a lot of it is just following the path of least resistance. If you don't, if you put up any resistance at all, you're probably not going to be taken. The victims that are described really didn't have, they didn't monitor any of their accounts. Sometimes bills came through the mail and they didn't even open them for months and months. I used to be one of these people. I am not one of these people anymore, having done these interviews. You have to have some minimal level of vigilance in monitoring. And if you will, they probably won't go after you because they're looking for the person who's just completely oblivious.
Who doesn't even have a password on their phone.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's a little encouraging after this conversation we've had this hour. Anna Maria, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Anna Maria Andriotis. She's a reporter who covers consumer credit for The Wall Street Journal. Doug Shadell, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Doug Shadell, Senior State Director of AARP Washington. He's based in Seattle. He's in New Hampshire this week to deliver a keynote address called Outsmarting the Scam Artists at AARP New Hampshire's Scam Jam on June 24th. If you want more information about some of the tips that our guests put out there this morning, we'll put them up on our website as soon as we can. So check them out, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, what's happening to our pollinators? Behind recent declines in bee populations are threats as diverse as pesticides, disease, and climate change, and fewer bees could mean a serious hit to global agriculture. We'll talk with beekeepers and researchers about what they're seeing, also what the future might hold, and what could be done. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and the Common Man family hosting cruise nights with cool classic cars at the 104 Diner in New Hampton and the Tilton Diner in Tilton all summer long. Dates and information at theseaman.com. And the Keene Sentinel serving the Monadnock region with local daily news coverage and innovative advertising solutions. Information and subscription sign up at sentinelsource.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua,
88.3. WEVH, Hanover,
91.3. WEVN, Keene, 90.7. WEVC, Gorham,
107.1. WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Secretary of State John Kerry arrives in Baghdad amid the threat of a widening sectarian war. Over the weekend, Sunni insurgents captured a key border post with Syria. As al-Maliki's Shiite-led government continues to lose ground to ISIS,